Hello, and welcome to Wordland. I'm your host, David Oates. Hope you are well in the midst of the current mess. This week we have essays by WUGA's own Robin Whetstone and by Jackson Hart, stories by Bill Harley and Stuart McLean, and a poem by Sonia Sanchez. I first met Jackson Hart at the Southern Fried Regional Poetry Slam in Americus, Georgia.
My dear friend Luke, this is the first time I've written since your death. For 6 months I found myself at a loss for words, nothing worthy enough to disrupt a blank page. Then today I questioned my negligence and reasons, deeming them weak, cowardly even. Because failing publicly, in this case by writing absolute shit, is a gift to those who are creative. It's how we grow and make better art, hopefully. It's also helpful for others to see that not every work is a masterpiece, especially on a subject as unwieldy as death. Thus, my first garbage paragraph begins. I could say that much has changed since you died, yet also much has stayed the same. But only the crueler and curious would suggest such, because all of us who loved you are profoundly changed by your loss. It's as though we were swimming along, oblivious to our current and buoyancy, then abruptly and unceremoniously tossed from the sea, forced to breathe differently, to forever endure the crushing gravity of your absence. That is to say, the wind was knocked out of me, and I don't think it will ever fully return. At least once a week, my internal monologue stops me cold in order to screech, "I cannot believe this." Yes, obviously denial is a stage, but the idea that it's something linear, a thing to move through or past, is insultingly naive to me. Grief is a Venn diagram of emotions. It comes in a riot of colors, pulsing with saturation, as competing feelings fade in and out, bright, then dim again. For instance, a few months ago, I was leveled by the thought that you'd never get to share a dog with your wife, Nicole. I was cooking dinner, and then I was doubled over, clutching my knees, racked with sobs as I railed at the injustice. 7 years together, with so many more ahead, and then boom, gone. Not even a dog. Can you imagine? I've said to friends not directly impacted by your loss. Imagine loving someone so easily and perfectly, and then they die unexpectedly, taken in the prime of both your lives, to be left with that crushing absence because you knew true love. You had it. I might muse aloud, I'd rather hate an ex forever, so long as they live. I'd rather never have loved at all. As though one can haggle or barter the unpredictable omnipotence of life, death, and love. It's a stupid game my brain likes to play when it's too painful to empathize. Or, be honest, when I need to disassociate from my own grief and observe it like a voiceover in a subpar movie. Back to Nicole. Your friends and I do our best to take care of her. It's a delicate balance to be there for someone who is grieving, while also grieving. Am I helping or smothering? Are my messages too frequent or too scarce? And then I remember how you always were. Exact. I'm here if you need me, wasn't your style. More like, I can hop on the phone right now for 30 minutes or after 5:45 and we can talk longer. Available, accountable, and adorably specific. So that's how I offer my help too. Though I must say I am disappointed in the people who keep their distance from your wife. Your widow. As though grief is contagious, like death won't pick off everyone eventually. In the quiet desolation of ourselves, the motley crew of friends you collected and cultivated, some don't know where to go or why. It's clear to me now that we came together not so much to drink or network or maybe get laid, but because of you. Of course, I go to almost anything you made happen. We all did. Which reminds me, I cried about my birthday party because you wouldn't be there. Then I cried about how you wouldn't have just been there. You would have rallied twice as many people to attend and maybe even brought a new person. Then I cried in anticipation of telling this moment to Anders, who was helping me organize the party. I knew he'd instantly understand and agree. No one can do it like you did. On days like that, my sadness is a hunger, devouring anything that can rouse my mood or move my emotional needle. But it's covert and functional. Those three crying jags, all on the escalator to my office building. My depression is ever a New Yorker, quick, efficient, multitask-oriented. It's also an old, familiar friend, friend though it be. Depression will remind me how good it feels to cancel all my plans because no one likes me anyway. It'll stay up late, caressing me with whiskey and whispering about nothing. No, I mean actually nothing. The call of the void. But isn't call from high places so much as water. I could drown. So do it. No, don't. I couldn't, though. My memorial would be pitifully modest next year's. Please excuse my gallow humor. It's all I have most days. There's a precipitous drop in laughter without your dad jokes, the cringers we both enjoyed inflicting on others. And just not funny right now. That life's too short thing people say before naming an intolerable task or experience? Yeah, I know. So pardon me while I navel gaze and try to check off some bucket list items before my bucket kicks at a time and place I can't predict. Anger is another one, isn't it? A stage. Still, I'm justifiably mad that there are terrible people walking around in this earth and you are not. It's so unfair you'll go crazy thinking about it. We have a hit list, Anders and I. We each keep a short list of people who should be dead instead of you and add to it regularly. Sometimes I have these solar flares of rage where I might wish death on a stranger who accidentally elbowed me on the train. You don't deserve this life, my brain screams. Maybe I need a vacation. I didn't get to say goodbye to you, but I did. I just didn't know it'd be the goodbye. I remember exactly where we were standing and that we made plans to see each other again. We check our calendars and follow up. I'll text you this week, you said. And this is where it ends for now, like one of our untidy, to-be-continued conversations that I know we'll pick up next time. I'm sure I'll have much more to say about you and to you. I carry your memory around like a special coin. I was so, so lucky to know you, and to say with confidence and pride that you're my friend. It's an impossible reality to say. My good friend died. What are these terrible words? They're surreal in their cruelty. No, there is no acceptance for this, but I'm resigned to go about my daily life without you, and I'm not okay about it. Like this.
Jackson Hartz, Letter to a Friend Who Died Too Soon. Last episode of Robin Whetstone's Red Ticket, she joined protesters facing down tanks after a military coup tried to turn Russia back into a totalitarian state. She returned.
My name is Robin Whetstone, and this is Red Ticket. In the first chapter of Red Ticket, I described how I survived the coup that toppled the Soviet Union. In this chapter, I move back to Russia to make things harder. Chapter 2, When Everything is Easy. I craned out of my dorm room window 23 stories above the frozen outskirts of the city. The snow whirled around my face, a kaleidoscope of icy crystal. 4 blocks away, I could see the metro station, a squat building surrounded by piles of slush. A panel truck idled in the small plaza, its exhaust graying the air. A clutch of men in black coats stood in front of its open back door. Were they buying or selling something? Was it something to eat? That's what I was looking for on this sub-zero January morning, my first in Moscow. I was hungry, but I didn't want to use up one of the 3 small cans of tuna fish I brought in my carry-on bag. Maybe from this height, I could spot a place to buy food. The boulevard in front of my dorm building was wide and empty, the snow in the street completely unmarred by cars. Across the street was a row of abandoned shops. I could see remnants of signs over each shuttered door, and I spent some time filling in the gaps in the blocky Cyrillic letters, practicing my Russian. Tsve-i, that one said. Must have once been a flower shop. My side of the street was empty except for my dorm building, which stood next to an iced-over retaining pond. All around me, it was gray and white, quiet. I leaned as far as I dared out the window, even though it was well below freezing. Everything smelled so strange and new. The air around me was tactile, furry, with floating ice. I was from Florida. This January morning in Moscow was the first time in 22 years that I'd ever seen snow. I was staring at the frozen pond next door when four old people in heavy coats shuffled onto it and began hacking at the ice with shovels and picks. They were stiff and slow, but they kept at it, snow collecting on their backs. I recalled what my college courses had taught about the crushing poverty of post-Soviet Russia. Communism had collapsed 2 years earlier, and state farms and factories sat empty, their workers unpaid. Russians who had spent careers as engineers and professors now picked up cigarette butts on the street, collecting shreds of the tobacco to re-roll and sell for a few rubles. Elderly people, like the ones cutting a hole in the pond, lived on monthly pensions that would now buy not quite a kielbasa. Shortages of basic necessities meant that want and hunger were widespread. This is why those folks were out there, I decided, even though it was only 8 in the morning, even though it was 3 degrees Fahrenheit under the gray Moscow sky. They were trying for food, hoping to coax a fish out from under the ice for their breakfast. People of their generation had endured the Nazis and Stalin's Siberian camps, not to mention 75 years of communism. They knew how to survive. They knew something about struggle. I was elated. This is exactly why you came here, I thought, to learn from the Russians about real life. In Florida, where I came from, people were proud of the fact that we were ruled by a cartoon mouse who lived in an extruded plastic castle downstate. They didn't care that almost everybody around them was from somewhere else, or that people came to Florida not to live, but to escape real life until they died. True, the North Florida military town I grew up in had more in common with Waycross than with Disney World. But even in my hometown, people seemed to prefer the artificial over the authentic, the convenient over the meaningful. When everything is easy, one quickly gets stupid. Maxim Gorky said it, and when I read it, I knew it was true. I could see it in the late-night glow of the televisions in everybody's bedroom window, in the long lines at the drive-thru. America was a shining mall upon a hill, and it made me angry that everybody around me seemed okay with this. Americans are too content, I thought, too lazy and too soft. But not those old Russians out there by the pond. They had finished their hole in the ice, and now they stood around it with their hands on their hips, surveying their work. Then, all at once, they began shrugging out of their heavy coats. They folded the coats onto the snow at the edge of the pond and went to work on their shirt buttons. The women stripped down to their bras and underwear. The men stood with boxer shorts flapping around their doughy thighs. One by one, they lowered themselves into the rectangle of slushy water. I watched, snowflakes clinging to my eyelashes as they splashed in the freezing water and then heaved and rolled in the snow as they pulled themselves out of the pond. They stood around laughing and chatting and stomping their feet, not yet reaching for their clothes. "They're naked old people frolicking outside," I said. It seemed important to say it out loud, to get it on the record. I pulled my head back in the window, and the ice that had collected into my nostrils melted down my face. I had been wrong about what those old people were up to, I thought, but not about Russia. If the nudists outside, who were now passing around a flask and laughing even more boisterously, were any indication, Russia was going to be interesting. And this is what I really wanted, even more than authenticity. I wanted a life worthy of the kind of book you just could not put down.
Robin Whetstone, Episode 2 from her collection Red Ticket. Bill Lepp is a professional storyteller.
This story is called Stop Sign Man, and it was actually created by my son Noah, who when I lay down at night with to tell him stories, he says, Daddy, tell me a story. And so I say, okay, once upon a time. And then he goes, okay, once upon a time, tell me this. There was a dragon, and there was a knight, and the dragon and the knight had a battle. So I go, okay, once upon a time, there was a dragon and a knight, and they had a... No. There was a dragon and a knight and a princess. And so he'll tell me exactly what he wants me to say. And this is actually a character that he created. In the land of streets and corners, there are many heroes and villains. But the most heroic hero of them all was a young boy who stood only 3 feet tall. He was small in stature, but possessed of powers unknown heretofore to any creature that flew, walked, or crawled across the floor. He wore a cape and an armored suit of red, but he carried neither sword nor wand, but a magic stop sign instead. Whenever there was mischief afoot or a bad guy up to evil design, Stop Sign Man would arrive in a rush, brandish his octagon, and shout, Stop Sign! And the evil doer would cease to do his evil doings thereabout. While Stop Sign Man was walking by the beach, he saw a ship anchored just out of reach. Ahoy! Came a cry from the ship. We're about to have our tea. Won't you come aboard and have a sip? Suspicious of the Jolly Roger flying above the ship's deck, Stop Sign Man shouted back, You are pirates! I won't risk my neck! Nay, yelled the pirate captain in a kindly voice, We are but friendly sailors who dress as pirates by choice. Have no fear, kind sir, we will not harm thee. Stop Sign Man flew to the ship, doubting the men, but thirsty for tea. Then as soon as Stop Sign Man landed, he realized the pirates were naughty, mean, dirty, and underhanded. The quite unfriendly pirates rushed at Stop Sign Man with swords rusted by oceanic brine. Acting quickly, Stop Sign Man bore his four-lettered scarlet peacemaker and shouted, Stop Sign! He arrested the pirates and read them their rights from his handy Miranda card. Then he promptly turned the bandits over to the local Coast Guard. Later, as Stop Sign Man was riding his horse over hill and dale, he heard a girl who had just begun to weep and wail. Stop Sign Man then passed an ox-drawn wagon just in time to see Princess Ellie almost singed by a fire-breathing dragon. Guiding his horse between the dragon and the distressed but royal dame, Stop Sign Man wielded his rosy polygon of goodness, shouting, Stop Sign! And shielded Ellie from the flame. The flame, obeying his command, stopped in midair. Stop Sign Man grabbed the frozen flame with a dashing flare, turned it around, and shoved it back down the dragon's reptilian throat with a mighty shout. The dragon coughed and wheezed, blowing backward smoke from his snout. He looked forlornly at Stop Sign Man and whimpered softly, If I promise to be nice, will you please take the backwards fire out? Stop Sign Man seized this unique opportunity and made the dragon swear to be good and always do his duty. The dragon agreed to forever uphold the laws of the land of streets and corners and by goodness to abide, and then, surprising both the princess and Stop Sign Man, the dragon became Stop Sign Man's loyal and magic ride. Princess Ellie and Stop Sign Man climbed upon the dragon's scaly back, and the three of them flew off into the Stop Sign Red sunset. Nothing did they lack.
Stop Sign Man, Bill Lepp, from the collection The Teacher and the Patriotic Bathing Suit. I often say, when someone says they hate aging, that I understand, but it's usually the better alternative.
Personal letter number 3. Nothing will keep us young, you know, not young men or women who spend their youth on cool playing sounds. We are what we never think we are. No more wild geographies of the flesh echoes that we move in tune to slower smells. It is a hard thing to admit that sometimes after midnight I am tired of it all.
Personal letter number 3, Sonia Sanchez, from the CD accompanying the book The 100 Best African American poems. My sister had a Canadian physical therapist who turned her on to Stuart MacLean. She, in turn, turned me on to the creator of the Vinyl Cafe.
For the past 20 years, Morley, faithful beyond fault, has gone to the same hairdresser whenever she needs her haircut. Morley goes to Lawrence. She found him when she and Dave moved into the neighborhood where they still live. A woman who has her priorities straight, Morley found Lawrence before she found a doctor or a dentist. And over the past 20-odd years, Morley has followed Lawrence from one salon to the next. Right from the start, Lawrence made Morley feel special. Instead of delegating the job to an assistant, Lawrence washed Morley's hair himself. He kept a special bottle of shampoo for her. He used it instead of the salon's usual rehydrating, mineralizing, oxygenating, detangling, protein-boosting, volumizing apricot shampoo with a jojoba infusion. If there is one thing in the world that Morley hates, it's a jojoba infusion. Lawrence remembers stuff like that. In fact, Lawrence's memory is the most appealing thing about Lawrence. Lawrence remembers things like how his clients take their coffee and things about their families. How was Sam's birthday, he would ask when Morley showed up for her next appointment. Morley felt that she and Lawrence had a special rapport, a relationship built on the important things of life, like history, trust, and jojoba. Over the past few years, however, things have been changing, slowly, slightly, but significantly, nevertheless. Over the past few years, Lawrence has let things slide. One afternoon, as she settled into his chair, Lawrence brought Morley a cup of tea instead of coffee. Another time, he used the foul-smelling apricot shampoo, and he would have finished off with hairspray if Morley hadn't stopped him. It had been years since Lawrence had asked Morley what she wanted done to her hair, or suggested a cut he thought would make her look good. Not the end of the world, to be sure. More a disappointment than a disaster. And Morley, faithful beyond fault, resigned herself to the changing and slightly diminished Lawrence, to the way things were rather than the way things used to be. She hadn't given it a lot of thought, not until the Saturday morning she went to get her hair cut and she came face to face with the salon's new stylist, a young hairdresser from Quebec with a liquid accent and spiky black hair. His name was Mathieu. And he had been assigned to the chair right beside Lawrence, although when Morley walked in, he was everywhere except the chair, jumping around the room, waving his scissors in the air, trying to persuade the woman he was working on to let him loose on her head. What's the worst that can happen? He called over his shoulder as he blew past Morley with his hands full of magazines. If you don't like what I do, we'll change it. And then he dropped to his knees in front of his chair. Please, I'm begging, he said. You were born to be a blonde. That was the day that Lawrence told her that he had been thinking of opening a salon for dogs. Waving his hands around, staring at Morley in the mirror, not looking at her hair at all as he cut it. Do you know how much you can charge for styling a Shih Tzu, he asked earnestly. Morley was telling Betty Schellenberger all about this when Betty called on Sunday night. Dave and Morley had just finished dinner, and Dave was lying on the couch reading the December issue of Canadian Living, absorbed by an article called Leaving the Bird Behind, Christmas Without a Turkey. Morley was moving around the kitchen, unloading the dishwasher, wiping counters, and talking to Betty on the portable phone. She was telling Betty all about Mathieu and what a riot he was, which of course led her to Lawrence and how Lawrence seemed to be slipping. 21 years, Morley was saying. We've been together for almost 21 years. 21 years, thought Dave. We've been married 23 years. Dave, out of sight but not out of earshot, overheard Morley talking on the phone in the kitchen, and Dave assumed that she was talking about him. How was Dave to know Morley was talking about her hairdresser? "He irritates me," said Morley. "He doesn't listen to me anymore." Dave, out of sight but not out of earshot, propped himself up on the couch. Okay, Dave shouldn't have been listening in, but he was listening in, and he was thunderstruck by what Morley was saying on the phone. "He used to know what I like," she said, "but I've changed. I'm ready to experiment. I've seen things in magazines I'd like him to try on me." "It used to take an hour. Now he speeds through it in 15 minutes. It feels like he's just going through the motions. He won't look me in the eye. He just looks in the mirror." Morley, his sweet wife, his partner of 23 years, his soulmate, the mother of his children, his rock. What had he done wrong? When had this started? What mirror? And now, what was she saying? She was saying, "Oh my God, there's another guy. I'd love to try him out. Just, you know, once maybe." Dave leapt off the couch, and he stood in the middle of the living room, his heart pounding. Morley, meanwhile, who had said goodbye to Betty, was heading upstairs. Dave watched her go, and then he bounded up the stairs behind her. And when he got there, Morley was standing in the bathroom, gazing in the mirror, and she was thinking, "My hair always will look the same. I will always look the same. I'll never be a blonde." She was so preoccupied with the state of her hair that she didn't notice Dave standing behind her when she picked up her toothbrush. Dave was standing there looking over her shoulder at her reflection in the bathroom mirror as she brushed her teeth. "Oh, hi," she said when she noticed him. And then she turned and she said, "Do you think loyalty is an important quality?" "What?" said Dave, trying to ignore the ringing in his ears. "If you're in a bad relationship," said Morley, "should you stay if you're just staying out of loyalty?" And she dropped her toothbrush in the glass on the counter and she flounced off to bed. She fell asleep immediately, snoring softly and twitching, and she dreamed that she was having her hair cut. And in the dream, Lawrence was using dog clippers. And when he finished, he charged her twice as much and gave her a milk bone. She tried to object, but all she could do was bark. Dave tossed and turned all night. By morning, Dave had worked himself into a complete panic. He went to Kenny Wong's cafe for lunch. He sat at the counter. I'm not really hungry," he said, finally settling on soup, barely touching it, finally fessing up. I think Morley's seeing someone else," he said. "Don't be crazy," said Kenny. "Morley wouldn't do that." Dave looked at Kenny forlornly. "Eat your soup," said Kenny. "Come back and talk to me if she starts behaving suspiciously." "Suspiciously," said Dave. "Like what?" "Well, you know," said Kenny, "if she changes her hairstyle, that sort of thing." As April folded into May, Morley couldn't stop thinking about Mathieu. And the more she thought about him, the more she yearned for a different haircut. Every day without Mathieu became a bad hair day. By the end of May, Morley could barely stand to brush her hair. She called the salon on a Wednesday afternoon. Wednesday was Lawrence's day off. She asked if they could fit her in for a style. "Not a cut," she said. "I'm not ready for a cut." "Mathieu's had a cancellation at 4, said the girl on the phone. "What's your name?" "Helen," said Morley. She wore a baseball cap and sunglasses to the salon, and she slinked past the receptionist and shampoo girl. She went there with her layered bob, intending to let Mathieu wash and style it, nothing more. But he stood behind her, and he held up her hair from the back, and he let it fall through his fingers like sand. Over and over, he picked up her hair and let it drop back to her shoulders, piece by piece, and he said, "I have to cut this." She knew it was coming. It was inevitable. If she didn't want him to cut it, why had she come? "Okay," she said, quietly. And when he had finished, she looked at herself in the mirror and she couldn't believe the change. She looked totally different, smarter, sophisticated. "I love it," she said. She couldn't wait for Dave to come home. So she headed off to the store instead. Dave was sitting behind the counter flipping through a magazine when Morley walked through the door. "I decided it was time for a change," she said. "What do you think?" 10 minutes later, Dave burst into Kenny Wong's cafe. "Don't panic," said Kenny. "Your job," said Kenny, "is to make a fuss. Your job is to win her back." And so Dave set off to woo his wife. He bought Morley a green Jane Jetson Pez dispenser. Morley always loved the Jetsons. And then he added a pack of refills at the counter. What the heck, he thought. She seemed to like the Pez, but Dave didn't think the presents had had enough of an effect. "What about flowers?" asked Kenny Wong. So the next day, Dave went to the florist. He couldn't believe his luck. They had Venus flytraps. Each day, he brought home something different. "Ever since Mathieu's cut my hair, he's been bringing me little treats," Morley told Betty. "It's so cute." "A Venus flytrap?" said Betty. "Yes," said Morley, "and a pair of wool socks and a bouquet of Tootsie Pops. Red ones." Morley loved the sudden attention almost as much as she loved her new hairdo. But she was plagued with guilt. She had to change the way she walked to work so she didn't go past the salon and accidentally bump into Lawrence. And one evening, when she saw Lawrence in the grocery store, she had to abandon her basket and bolt. "I gotta stop this," she told Betty. "I can't keep seeing him. Not like this." But she went again on a Wednesday afternoon in September. "I'll need 3 hours, said Mathieu. "I want to add some color." Morley, who had never even had highlights, was reluctant. "I don't know," she said. "Trust me," said Mathieu. "You'll love it." So while Morley was sitting in the salon chair, guilty, nervous, and excited, Dave was slumped behind the counter in his record store, staring at the piece of paper that he had found on the kitchen table that morning. There were 3 words written on it. They were written in Morley's handwriting. "Mathieu, 2 o'clock. Dave was staring at the paper and reaching for the phone, about to call Betty Schellenberger. It had taken him all day to screw up the courage to make the call. If anyone knew what was going on, Betty Schellenberger would. "Betty," said Dave, getting right to the point. "Betty," said Dave, "do you know about Mathieu?" "Of course," said Betty. "It's not exactly a secret." "She hasn't told me," said Dave. "Well, Dave," said Betty, "it's not something you'd necessarily share with your husband, is it?" "I have a date with him, too. I haven't told Arnie." "You're seeing him, too?" said Dave. Yes, said Betty. Gerda's coming with me. Two at once, said Dave. Of course not, said Betty. One after the other. He does my whole bridge club, Dave. Everybody loves Mathieu. Oh, my God, croaked Dave. Honestly, Dave, on a Saturday morning, people line up to see Mathieu. My last appointment was so good, said Betty, that I gave him a $30 tip. Why is this happening, said Dave. Things get stale, Dave, said Betty. Mathieu has amazing technique. He's French, you know. Where do they meet, said Dave. His place, of course, said Betty. Give me the address, said Dave, filled with a sudden resolve. Mathieu had already began Morley's transformation as Dave flew down the street. Dave was checking numbers as he ran. He was running without thinking what he was going to do when he got to where he was going. He was just consumed by the need to act. And when he found the right number, he burst through the salon door without registering where he was or what was going on around him. He spotted Morley before he spotted anything else. His wife, Morley, a black nylon cape cinched tightly around her neck, half her head covered in clumps of hair, the other half festooned with dozens of little pieces of tinfoil. Something red dribbling down her face. His wife, Morley, had never looked worse. He had never loved her more. Morley, he blurted out, I love you. Don't go through with this. It's not too late. Everything in the salon screeched to a halt. And as it did, Dave slowly took in his surroundings. The women sitting in the chairs, the stylists with their hair dryers poised in midair, the spiky-haired young man with his mouth gaping open, hovering over Morley with a paintbrush in his hand. All things considered, the salon staff were very nice to Dave. They guided him to a quiet corner in a soft chair, and they bought him a coffee, and he sat and he waited, and after the coloring was finished, he and Morley walked home together. I told him I wanted something natural, said Morley as they walked along. It is natural, said Dave, pointing at the bright red leaves on the maple tree in the park. They sat on a park bench under that tree, and Dave, overcome with love and relief, finally asked the question that he had been afraid to ask before he knew the answer. Are you still happy with me? He asked. Is everything okay? Morley looked at him with her licorice red streaks and said, of course it's okay. I would have told you if it wasn't. And so it was 6 weeks later that Morley called the salon and booked an appointment with Lawrence. And before she went, she phoned Lawrence himself. I feel a little embarrassed about this, she said. And she told him everything about the day he had brought her tea instead of coffee, about the time he had used the apricot shampoo, and about Mathieu. Lawrence was a little chilly the first time she saw him, but she didn't let him get away with it. We have to try something different, she said, and it has to be your idea. I was thinking, said Lawrence, we could start with apricot shampoo. That's when she knew they were going to be okay. And she isn't wrong. They will be okay. Though it's going to take a little longer than she thinks. Lawrence will suggest things and they will try them, but not many of the things will work. Morley was never meant to be a blonde or have dreadlocks. But it won't be what they're doing that counts, just that they are doing something new and they're doing it together. As for Dave, Dave will keep bringing her stuff all winter long. Root beer flavored jelly beans, sponge toffee. And on her birthday, instead of going out to one of the neighborhood restaurants they favor this year, he'll cook for her, just the way he did when they were dating. Heating cheddar cheese hot dogs in the toaster oven and roasting marshmallows over the gas flame of the stove. Thank you very much.
Maestro Stuart MacLean, the hairdresser, from his Family Pack. If you like his stories, check out www.vinylcafe.com. There are also podcasts of his stories. At least in this telling, Bill Lepp had a unique undergraduate experience.
I went to West Virginia Wesleyan College in Buchanan, and I had a really good friend. His name was Paul. And Paul was a mosquito of a man. He was about 5'2", and he weighed about 98 pounds. And about 44 of those pounds were hair. He had a tremendous head of red hair, and then a giant red biker's beard. And in some strange genetic fashion, the beard and the hair were different shades of red. So it looked like to me that there were two different factions of red ants battling for supremacy of Paul's head. And when he didn't have any clothes on, which unfortunately was more often than not, you could see patches of red hair all over his body. And it always seemed to me that the red ants that got killed would tumble down his body and just get stuck in clumps somewhere along the way. But he was a genius. He was an absolute genius when it came to tinkering with things. And when we had about 4 weeks of college left, our senior year, between the two of us, we had about 7 term papers to write, about 6 foreign languages to learn, and about 17 chemistry labs to finish. But about 4 weeks from the end of school, we decided that we just weren't going to do any of those things. And because we had thought about doing them, we had collected a huge amount of library books in our dorm room. We had about, I don't know, maybe 50 reference books in our dorm room. And we decided that the thing to do would be to take those books back to the library so that someone else would have the opportunity to use them, some student who was actually going to try and do his or her work. So we loaded ourselves down with reference books. We had them stacked from about our thigh to our chin, and we waddled across campus to the library, and we sort of kicked the doors open. There were these great swinging doors in the front of the library, and we sort of kicked them open. And about 10 yards in front of the doors was the circulation desk. And standing at the circulation desk when we kicked our way in was Dr. Milton Toast. And Dr. Milton Toast was the dean of the library and the dean of students. Now, we all called him Dr. Milk Toast, because he had not been out in the sun for about 35 years, and he had the complexion of skim milk. We were pretty sure that he was the product of a strange union between, like, a cave-dwelling cricket and a zombie. But when we kicked our way into the door swung open, and Dr. Toast sort of went, huh, like that, which was a reaction that Paul and I were used to whenever we walked into a building that housed, you know, antiquities or art or rare books, sort of like that. And we just kind of shuffled on up to the desk with those reference books. And Dr. Toast said, "It's always a pleasure to see you, boys. I trust you haven't brought those tiny fishing poles with you." Now, this was a reference to an embarrassing but understandable incident when Paul and I had brought tiny fishing poles to the library after we heard that they had microfish at the library. But we walked up to the circulation desk and we put those books down on the desk, and Dr. Toast started to look at them and he said, "These are reference books." We said, "Yeah, that's why we brought them back." He said, "These are reference books." I said, "Yeah, we found them in the dormitory. We thought we'd bring them back." He said, "These are reference books." I said, "I know, that's why we brought them back." He said, "Reference books cannot leave the library." I said, "I know, that's why we brought them back." He said, "Reference books cannot leave the library." And it suddenly dawned on me what he was saying. He wasn't saying that they weren't allowed to go out of the library. In his world, he thought that it was an impossibility for a reference book to leave the library. You could check out a toilet from his library easier than you could check out a reference book. Tectonic plates cannot cease to shift. The sun can't rise in the west. Reference books can't be checked out of the library. So he was sort of getting pale and even more jittery than he usually was, and we just said, well, we brought him back, and we left as quick as we could. And we got back to our dorm room, and there in the middle of the floor was the B encyclopedia. I said, Paul, why didn't you take this one back? And he said, well, I thought of something I can do for the next 4 weeks. And he opened it up to nearly the back to an article on a man named Bushnell. And here I got to throw a parenthesis into the story, because for the next few minutes, the story will be true. And when we get to the end of the truthful part, I'll throw that parenthesis, that end parenthesis up, so you can see where you can quit believing the story anymore. But he turned to this article on Bushnell, and Bushnell was a guy who had invented the very first submarine. He invented it during the Revolutionary War in 1776. And essentially what he did was he took a big wine cask and he put a seat in it and he put a couple of pedals in it and a couple of levers and a couple of handles so that he could adjust the yaw and the pitch of the submarine from the side. He had a propeller on the top that he could crank so he could go up or down. And he had propellers on the back and a rudder so that he could steer and go in whatever direction he needed to. And then he had taken a drill bit and put that on the top of the submarine. And what Bushnell's plan was to go into the Boston Harbor, go up underneath British warships, drill holes in the bottom of them, attach bombs, and then cruise away in a submarine before the bomb exploded. This was sort of the original Homeland Security Force. But what he didn't know is that the British warships were now encased in brass on the bottom. They were trying to keep barnacles off, so his drill didn't work. But the submarine did, and he called it the Turtle. And so Paul said to me, and this is the end of the parenthesis, Paul said to me, I'm going to build a submarine before the school year is over. Well, he went out and he bought from a farmer, he bought about a 180-gallon heating oil tank. You know, those old oval heating oil tanks. He had a couple of football players carry it up to the third floor where we lived. And then he went out and bought two 55-gallon drums. He took those up to his room. And then he went home for the weekend. And when he came back, he had all of his welding equipment with him. And you could hear him in there at night welding and sawing away on these three giant metal casks as he put this submarine together. And I think it's safe to say that Paul was the only guy on the third floor of McCuskey Dormitory that had an active shipyard going on in his room. But when he was finally finished, he had an open house and he let us all come in and see it. And he had taken that big oil drum and he had welded those 55-gallon drums to the side of it. And he had painted the whole thing battleship gray. And I said to him, Paul, that sort of looks like two baby hippopotami suckling on their mother. Well, that made him mad, so he kicked us all out of the room, bought some pink paint, painted the whole thing pink. And then it looked like two piglets suckling on a sow. But he seemed to enjoy that, so he painted eyes and put noses on them. But he let us look inside, and it was really a genius thing. He had cut off a bicycle and the seat so you could sit on that, and he still had the pedals and the chains. You could pedal the pedals. The chain ran underneath of him out the back of the submarine. There was a propeller so he could go forward. And then he had stabilizers on the side, and then he had these two enormous air canisters, like scuba divers wear, hooked up to those 55-gallon drums. And through a series of knobs, he could turn the knobs and fill those drums up with water so that he could go down, and then he could blast air into them so that he could rise back up to the surface. Well, it was a beautiful thing, and he called it the Turtle 2. And he said to me, I want you to help me test drive it. And I said, Paul, there is no escape hatch on that thing. And he said, well, I'm an optimist. And that was the first time in my life that I realized that optimist and moron were synonyms. I said, I don't think I want to help you test this thing. And he said, oh, all you got to do is stand by the side of the river, and if I don't come back up after 15 minutes, you call a tow truck, and they'll come in and we'll just haul me out of the river. I said, oh, I can do that. I said, where are we going to test it? And he said, well, I found a deep part of the Buckhannon River way down past French Creek. He said, we'll go down there. I said, how are we going to get it there? And he showed me that he had welded some axles to the bottom of that submarine, and he had put Yugo rims on those axles. And he said, we're going to take it out, we're going to put it on the railroad tracks, and we're just going to push it down to that section of the river. I said, Paul, I don't think that's a good idea, pushing the submarine down railroad tracks. He said, oh, these are deserted railroad tracks. He said, with God as my witness, these are deserted railroad tracks. Now, when your good friend says, with God as my witness, you ought to believe him. But there's not every reason. You should ask yourself a couple of questions. First of all, you should ask yourself, have I known this person ever to express any faith in any deity whatsoever? He's from Maryland. Has he ever been to this stretch of railroad tracks? And I know now that you should ask those questions, but I didn't know it then. So we went to take the Turtle 2 out of his dorm room, but we found out that it was a lot bigger than his door. So what Paul did is he went up on the roof of the dormitory and he rigged up a little crane. And then he prepared what you might call a small explosive device. And he put it right next to the window in his dorm room. And what he was going to do was blow out a small hole in the side of the wall, take the window out, and then the hole would be large enough that we could just lower the Turtle 2 safely down into the bed of a pickup truck. Well, the bomb was slightly larger than he had anticipated. And when it exploded, it scared me so much that I sort of jumped. And when I did, I bounced into the Turtle 2, which immediately started to roll out the hole before we could grab the ropes on the pulley to slow it down. Fortunately, its fall was broken because Dr. Milton Toast just happened to be pulling in at that moment in his brand new car, and that broke the fall. We tried to explain it to him, but it's difficult to reason with a man who has just seen three pigs falling on him and is presently being extracted from his brand new car by the jaws of life. So we just sort of let it go. We loaded the Turtle 2 up into the back of a pickup truck. We went out to this, with God as my witness, deserted stretch of railroad tracks, laid the Turtle 2 on the tracks, and Paul had some motor oil with him. We put a little motor oil on each one of those Yugo rims, and we could just push the thing right along the tracks. We'd push it, get it going up a pretty good speed, and then we'd just kind of jump on and ride it for a while. It's kind of like when you're in the grocery store and you got the cart and you see how fast you can get it going down the aisle and jump onto it before your mother yells at you. And it was about this time that I realized, as we were pushing the Turtle 2 down these railroad tracks, that every college male should be required to bring his mother with him to school. I think far fewer dumb things would happen in college if you had your mother with you most of the time. But our mothers weren't there to tell us, don't do that, that's stupid. So there we were, pushing the Turtle 2 down the railroad tracks. We came to a slight downgrade. We just jumped on the thing. We got up a pretty good head of speed. We could just ride on top. And as we were riding up on top, I had a little bit of leisure time. And every now and again, we'd just drip a little motor oil on the rims to keep them flowing. And as I was doing that, I looked down at the railroad tracks. And I noticed that they were shiny. And I don't know what you know about railroad tracks, but they're made out of steel. And they can rust overnight if you have a heavy dew. If you have a steady stream of trains coming up and down the tracks will shine like mirrors. And as I was dripping oil on the Yugo rims, it suddenly occurred to me that I could see my reflection going by at about 90 miles an hour on those tracks. I said, Paul, are you sure these tracks are deserted? We were coming around a curve about that time, and he said, with God as my witness, these tracks are deserted. And just then we heard the low whistle of a train. And as we came around that curve, we saw a 168-car CSNX monster train loaded down with 19,364 tons of pure West Virginia bituminous coal coming right at us. And I could hear a little sloshing noise inside that submarine for the first time. I said, Paul, what's that? He said, oh, I couldn't get all the heating oil out of the tank. But it didn't really worry me except when I was welding. So I didn't pay any attention to it. And just about that time, that train hit us, and it changed our direction dramatically. It shot us back down the tracks, and the cattle guard on that train caught up underneath the submarine, and when we got to the curve in the tracks, it just lifted us and shot us straight up into the sky. Now, the friction had been so great on those Yugo wheels that the oil on them had caught on fire, and now there was a hole in the bottom of the submarine, and heating oil was flowing out of that tank, and as it hit those Yugo rims, it ignited. So we had just gone from two guys riding three pigs down the railroad tracks to two guys riding a rocket-propelled submarine through the sky. I was trying to figure out how I could save us as we started going over the top of campus there, and right in the middle of West Virginia Wesleyan campus, if you don't know, there's a giant chapel, and that chapel has a huge steeple. And I realized this was the only chance I was going to have to save us. So I reached in my pocket and I pulled out my stainless steel 74 function Swiss Army type knife. And I quickly opened up the anchor and the come along. And I took the anchor and I swung it above my head a couple of times on that big chain. And just as we went over the steeple, I slung it out and caught the steeple with the anchor, put the chain on the come along and started cranking as hard as I could. We made smaller and smaller revolutions around that steeple till I felt we were going slow enough that I just disconnected and we started flying towards the ground. Paul was up on top of that submarine with his hat waving and his legs kicking, doing his best Slim Pickens and Dr. Strangelove as we headed toward the ground. But we weren't headed directly toward the ground. We were headed toward an office window. And we saw in that office window a figure standing with an expression on his face that only a man who has seen three pigs flying at him twice in one day can have. Dr. Milton Toast was drinking tea in his window. But I think what surprised him more than anything, more even than the three pigs flying at him the second time that day, was that Paul had on the front of the submarine, in a waterproof case, he had enshrined the Bee Encyclopedia as sort of a monument to Bushnell. So now Dr. Milton Toast was watching the Bee Encyclopedia flying directly at him, and it crashed through the window and hit him right in the chest and knocked him clear across his office. And when he recovered, he got up and he came toward us. And oddly enough, I think he was happy to see us, because he reached in the bottom drawer of his desk and he pulled out two diplomas. And he laid them on the desk and he told us that if we promised to never, ever, ever come back to West Virginia Wesleyan College again, even for an alumni function, we could graduate that day. And I think it's safe to say that we were the first people to graduate from West Virginia Wesleyan College with a triple major in swinology, aeronautics, and submarine engineering. But the best thing about it was that it finally solved an argument between my parents, because my mother had always said that I would graduate from college one day, but my father said that he thought I wouldn't graduate from college until pigs flew. Thank you.
Bill Lepp from the album The Teacher in the Patriotic Bathing Suit. That's our show, so this is David Oates saying goodbye, and thanks for listening to Wordland.
Wordland is a Monkey Sound production recorded in the studios of WUGA. If you have questions or comments, please call your radio station or send email to dvdoates@aol.com. That's dvdoates@aol.com.